Welcome to this WNRI special report on the coronavirus. This hour, we'll hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, describing the complicated timeline and process of creating a vaccine, the risk in different stages of development of that vaccine as well. We'll also hear from Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, the executive chairman of the Los Angeles Times. He'll give an overview of a special series called The Science Behind the Coronavirus. We'll start off this hour with a rebroadcast of a special CNN report giving an overview on the coronavirus.
Since the novel coronavirus first appeared in Wuhan, China in late 2019, it has spread across the world. Coronaviruses are a large group of viruses common among many species of animals, including humans. There have only been two other coronaviruses that have been known to be deadly. The Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, known as MERS virus, that caused severe respiratory problems, and the CDC estimated that 3 out of 4 of every 10 patients infected with MERS had died. Another one is the Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS. Now, that had an average death rate of around 10%, with older people being the most vulnerable. Viruses can spread from human contact with animals. Scientists think MERS, for example, started in camels, and they suspect that SARS started with civet cats. As for human-to-human transmission, often it happens when someone is within 3 feet of the infected person.
How does a virus spread? There are plenty of ways. It could be a sneeze, a handshake, or sexual contact, to name a few. Then there's our habits, washing our hands, not touching our face. Even the climate may play a role in determining how far and how fast an infection spreads. Scientists have summed up how far an infection can spread with a number. It's called R0. A number greater than 1 indicates it'll grow. Less than 1 indicates the outbreak will die out. Scientists determine the number with a formula that brings together all the environmental and biological factors. This is how it looks in reality. An infection is introduced to a human, from an animal, let's say. The bigger the R0 number, the more people a virus can infect. So an R0 of 2 means that patient 0 will, on average, infect 2 other people, who in turn can infect another 2 people, and so on. An infection like measles sits higher up the spectrum, with an R0 of between 12 and 18. At the lower end is something like Ebola, with an R0 number of 1.5 to 2.5. And while the flu varies from year to year, one study reports it averages to 1.2. But as various factors change, so too does the R0. Take SARS. When it first emerged, SARS spread rapidly with a high R0, but people were only contagious once symptoms started showing. Once people were informed about the symptoms, they started coming to the hospital earlier. People could check themselves into hospital before infecting other people, pushing the R0 number below 1.
When a virus spreads, the number of people who are infected can quickly rise. This sharp increase can overload the healthcare system with sick patients who need intensive care. One solution is to increase the healthcare system's capacity, whether that's by building hospitals, training additional doctors, or buying more equipment. But that takes time and resources, which countries don't always have during an epidemic. Another option is to slow the spread of the virus, something experts call flattening the curve.
Get the curves of outbreaks, you know, they go big peaks and they come down. What we need to do is flatten that down. That would have less people infected. That would ultimately have less deaths.
This is done by relying on people in the community to use protective measures to help slow the spread of the virus. The goal is not necessarily to reduce the overall number of cases, although that is often a positive side effect, but rather to spread the cases out over an extended period of time. This means the healthcare system will be able to treat critical patients as they come in and better cope with the strain that outbreaks place on the medical system. Most of the people with the novel coronavirus aren't dying. Symptoms start out like the flu, with coughing, fever, and shortness of breath. And most healthy people's immune systems are able to fight off the virus. But the disease can be deadly to people who have weakened immune system, like older adults, and those with pre-existing medical conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and lung disease. Their bodies have a harder time combating the virus. These are the ways COVID-19 can turn deadly. Pneumonia. COVID-19 is a respiratory disease, meaning it starts and typically ends in the lungs. Infected lungs fill with fluid, making it difficult to breathe, so oxygen can't get to the rest of the body, which can lead to death. sepsis. The fight between the virus and the immune system may cause collateral damage throughout the body. Sepsis occurs when your body essentially overreacts to an infection. This out-of-control immune response can cause more damage than good and ultimately end in organ failure and death. Contact your doctor right away if you experience any COVID-19 symptoms and you've possibly been exposed to the virus.
Limiting transmission between individuals is vital to help contain the outbreak. So here's what you can do to protect yourself. Health experts agree that you should wash your hands regularly, thoroughly as well, with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Don't forget your thumbs. Don't forget underneath your nails. If soap and water aren't available, you can use a hand sanitizer, but make sure that it's at least 60% alcohol. Do avoid close contact with anyone who is coughing or sneezing. What you're trying to do is avoid the airborne droplets that can spread the disease. Avoid touching your face at all. We do this hundreds of times a day. Avoid touching your face, but especially with unwashed hands, as the virus can enter your body through your eyes, your nose, and your mouth. If you do cough or sneeze, don't do it into your hands. Instead, use the crook of your elbow or use a tissue. Unless you're already sick, don't wear a mask. This is important. Wearing a mask can actually increase your risk of getting infected if you wear that mask improperly. Individuals do have an important role to play here, but society-wide measures are also going to help stem the global spread of this virus. While affected countries have used a range of responses, containment efforts can be effective here. The lockdown of the entire city of Wuhan is thought to have helped slow the initial spread of the virus, and that bought valuable time for preparations elsewhere. Since then, large-scale quarantines have been used in some of the worst affected areas in the world. I should point this out, that large quarantines have not really been used in the United States for decades. The world has changed a lot since then, so it is hard to know just how effective these quarantines would be today. Restricting large gatherings of people may also help prevent the transmission of this virus. Early detection of cases through testing, that's the key. And some countries have taken it to the next level. For example, in China, they quickly deployed thermal monitoring technology to record temperatures. And in South Korea, they pioneered further innovations like drive-through testing. From providing emergency resources and investment to building infrastructure at speed, governments around the world now are working to contain and then mitigate this outbreak. And the vast majority of people who contract the virus do recover. So while novel coronavirus and the anxiety about it continue to spread, remember, there are things that can be done to fight back.
We'll return in a moment to this coronavirus special on WNRI. When we return, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong and the science behind the coronavirus.
The following message is from Kay's Restaurant, Woonsocket. We are in uncharted waters at this time, but we thank our local, state, and federal leaders for their efforts in trying to get us back to where we should be. We don't know when that's going to happen, but we pray it happens soon. And during this unfortunate situation, we thank you so very much for coming to Kay's and ordering takeout. But this is a much broader community concern. There are many other Woonsocket area restaurants and businesses that deserve our support. They're the same businesses that give out gift cards and gift certificates to our community organizations. So look around and see what you can do to support our business community. And stay safe and follow the guidelines that officials are offering for responsible behavior. And when it's all over, we'll be better people for it. From the LaHoos family, God bless.
This is News Talk WNRI bringing you this coronavirus special. The following has been produced by the Los Angeles Times, by the executive chairman, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong. In addition to being executive chairman of Los Angeles Times, he's also a surgeon and scientist who spent his career studying the human immune system, fighting cancer and other infectious diseases. He's also chairman and CEO of several research companies, including the company researching immunotherapies for the COVID-19 virus. Now, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong.
My name is Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, and I'm here today to present to you the science behind the coronavirus. I really think it's really important for us to present some of the science because it's very clear to me that there's a lot of fear out there. And what adds to the fear is confusion. But if you could present the science and really try and understand not only how does this coronavirus work, how does it infect the body, what does it do, and how we can actually attack it, we have an opportunity to really provide some peace of mind, some level of control in the hands not of every individual, but the entire community. I'm really excited by the fact that this coronavirus has attacked us in 2003, and we have the benefit of that insight and scientific knowledge. But we also today have tools that we didn't have then. We have more genomics, we have more bioinformatics, we have supercomputing. And together with those tools, I think we have a real shot at not only defeating this virus, but overcoming this pandemic. So in order for me to take you through this complex story of this coronavirus today, we will talk about how do we understand this virus? How does the virus infect your body? And more importantly, explain the symptoms that are associated with this infection. What can we do to control and prevent its spread? And excitingly, what is on the horizon that the entire world scientists as a community are working together to cure this infection and prevent us from getting this in the first place? There are some questions we won't be able to fully answer yet. Is how long is this pandemic? Will this pandemic last? I think it's important that this one-hour special will have a separate, maybe a slightly different lens. While the world is working on very significantly on how to kill the virus, we want to take this lens of what does this virus do to your body, i.e. the host, and how can we prevent it getting into your body, into the cells? How can we actually treat the host or the patient to prevent it becoming a severe fatal disease? So while on the one hand, we were working hard to develop a vaccine, and I think it's important and realistically important for us to identify a treatment now for those that are severely ill. Let me start on what is the coronavirus. You've seen a lot of names, coronavirus, COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, SARS, and they all in essence mean the exact same thing here. This virus is a RNA virus. What I mean by that, the genetic signature inside this virus, that little curly, is made of a RNA that can reproduce. But most importantly, the virus has on its surface an envelope or a capsule. And then you see the spikes. And the spikes form a crown, and that's why it's called coronavirus. In 2019, it created this disease in China, and that's what COVID-19 was the first name, coronavirus disease in 2019, COVID-19. And now the World Health Organization has created an official name. This is the latest scientific name, SARS-CoV-2. And why SARS-CoV-2? Because this is a second generation daughter virus of SARS. And why is that important to us? Well, it's given us a head start. It's given the scientists a head start since 2003, 2004, 2005 to fully understand this family of coronaviruses, specifically SARS and now SARS-CoV-2. What's exciting about that is we now have in our fingertips supercomputing, genomics, bioinformatics that wasn't as advanced even in 2003. And this is now allowing us to understand how contagious is this coronavirus. Because sadly, this mutation has allowed SARS-CoV-2 to become 1,000 times more infective than that of SARS. And that is the fear. The fear is SARS was an endemic, limited in its scale and scope, but now SARS-CoV-2 is a pandemic. So the question that we need to understand is, how does this enter your body? What does this do? How does it affect the cell? How does it affect the lung? And what organs does it affect? I think this is an opportunity for us to take a different lens of understanding the host effects rather than just the virus itself. And if we look at that host effects, we now truly have a shot at trying to block it and block the ability to get to SARS. So firstly, is an infected person has the ability to contaminate 2.6 other patients. And how does that happen? Well, it's droplets, and this nanoparticle of a virus forms droplets, and these droplets can go on surfaces and then go into your hand. The important fact is that your hand is now a vector. We'll come back to how we can use that fact to our advantage and kill the virus. But the lungs, what happens inside the cell? Well, this virus has now hijacked this receptor in our body called the ACE2 receptor. This receptor is on blood vessels, this receptor is on kidney, and even on heart, but most importantly on the what we call the alveolar cells of the lung. It's in a very important receptor called ACE2 because it's there in your body to protect your lung tissue from injury. What has happened is this virus, through its spikes, has figured out a way to interact with that receptor and use that receptor to dock. The virus goes on now to take advantage of the cell itself and use the cell as a factory. It's now taken on what we call taking the RNA inside the virus itself. It breaks it up and remarkably takes the what we call the Golgi apparatus, the machinery of the human cell, to reproduce itself and repackage. And in so doing, it propagates. So this is the issue of how the virus actually regenerates and sheds. Now we are full circle because that shedding of that positively charged patient has ability to contaminate others. And the opportunity, however, to stop not just, unfortunately, the shedding, but stop that propagation is what containment is all about.
More of the science behind the coronavirus when we return.
The wastewater treatment plant of the city of Woonsocket is reminding customers not to flush wipes of any kind into the system. And although the packaging might say flushable, they should never be flushed down the toilet. Only flush the three P's, poop, pee, and paper. Flushable wipes are not truly flushable. They might go down, but they do not break up like regular toilet paper. If you do use paper towels or wipes, throw them into your trash cans. Remember, wipes of any kind can clog our sewer systems and even harm your home's plumbing. The practice of flushing wipes is causing problems at the treatment plant and unnecessary expenses to the city of Woonsocket. This announcement presented by the Woonsocket Wastewater Treatment Facility.
More of the science behind the coronavirus. Now, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong.
Not only is this virus highly contagious, but it is also deadly. And this is the map or the results that the Chinese have put out with regard to the pattern of disease progression in China. And there are three types of symptoms or patients: mild, moderate, severe, and critical. And what you see from this is the patients that are severe and critical progress very rapidly to the intensive care unit and rapidly to death. This can happen as rapidly as 3 to 4 weeks. But it doesn't exclude the patients who are mild or moderate. While rare, it doesn't exclude them. And this chart, again, of 44,000 cases in mainland China has separated the fatality as it relates to age. And as one could see from this chart, the yellow is that greater than 80 and 70 to 79 and 60 to 69 are the predominant patients who die from this disease. But unfortunately, there are deaths in patients who are 40 to 49, 30 to 39, 20 to 29, and even 10 to 19. So while it certainly the majority of patients have mild symptoms, the young aren't protected yet from this fatality rate. And why does this happen? Well, the way this virus works is as it replicates and it becomes, overtakes this protective ACE2 receptor, fibrosis occurs, meaning scarring. And that's why 100% of these patients who have fatalities have this ground glass effect in their lungs. And there's no longer any oxygenation. The body tries to take this over, sadly we end up then with what we call SARS, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome, in which, in essence, it is impossible for the body to get enough oxygen to the rest of the organs, and we have what we call multi-organ failure. This happens, unfortunately, not only mainly in the elderly, but also those with pre-existing conditions. And as you could see, patients with cardiovascular disease, diabetes, respiratory disease, and high blood pressure have this pre-existing conditions or are prone, if they get infected, to end up with SARS. We are now learning on a day-by-day basis what are the clinical effects of SARS. We are understanding and beginning to sort of see hypertension, severe hypertension, cardiac failure, and even a very interesting finding of low potassium in the blood. So the Chinese, again, are putting out this data in rapid fashion and allowing clinicians and people who are looking after such patients to find ways to combat the SARS. It is also important for us to understand these are the patients who will require ICU. And we'll talk a little bit again about flattening the curve. We have really have an opportunity as an entire community and as a country to not only flatten the curve, but not overwhelm the healthcare system so that the ICUs and this medical staff can be available to treat these patients, not only with these pre-existing conditions, but to take a patient from critical and severe all the way back to moderate and mild. It is important for all of us to understand the ability for this virus to spread and how it does so. It has a spreading factor of about 2.6, and what does that mean? The New York Times has put together a video that I think beautifully explains the real contagious capability of this virus. Let's imagine there were five people who are sick, and one cycle meaning it's within this five people. Well, if there is an infection rate of 2.6, and that's mathematically we call it exponential, what would happen within two cycles, that would become 18 people who are sick. Three cycles, 52 people are sick. Four cycles, 140 people are sick. And after five cycles, we have over 300 people that are sick. This is what we mean by isolating people that are infected. This was, by the way, the value of the test. The purpose of isolating people who are sick is to flatten the curve. What we mean by that is if we can identify these patients that are ill, we can actually, with protective measures or with isolation, flatten the curve. And the importance of flattening that curve is we can protect the healthcare system's capacity so that we can actually have sufficient ICUs, sufficient medical personnel, sufficient medical supplies to deal with the inevitable, sadly inevitable, severe and critically ill patients who may die from this disease. So it's beholden to all of us to work together to identify those patients or yourselves or your family members or your friends of visits from overseas who may have the symptoms of this disease and either self-isolate even without a test, because it's critical for all of us to create the extinction of this virus by self-isolating and allowing then the healthcare systems to manage with the very ill patient. If we have to self-isolate or have patients isolate so they prevent this exponential growth of this pandemic, we need to understand what are the symptoms, even without a test. So this is the issue. We can, and through the experience again of the Chinese, understand how do we recognize at least an infection. We need to know who's most vulnerable. Are men more at risk? Are children at risk? We need to ask the question, how long does a virus stay in your body? With regard to the last question, disturbingly, there's now some reports that virus can stay in your body for more than 30 days. So the first question then is to recognize either yourself, your friend, your family member that has an infection, And this is a report, again, from the Chinese experience of over thousands of cases. And here is Wuhan City, Hubei province, and the country as a whole, where the Chinese rapidly got out the information that fever and cough, a dry cough, are some of the hallmarks of this infection. So anybody with a fever or dry cough should suspect, without a test even, and go to the extent of self-isolating and prevent then this contamination either amongst their family members, their friends, and their co-workers. What's of concern, however, is what percentage are severe or critical. I think the good news is that 81% of symptoms are mild, but the concern is in patients with pre-existing conditions in the elderly. If you take again this case report now, 44,000 confirmed cases in mainland China, you see from their experience, patients who require hospitalization, they call that severe or critical in intensive care. If you add those together, that represents 18%. So if you then extrapolate what potentially could happen in our country and the number of patients that could get infected, and then say 18% of such patients will require hospitalization or intensive care units, that means we need sufficient beds. That means we need sufficient ICU personnel. That means we need to preserve at all costs the resources of the healthcare system. That is why I can emphasize so much that we need to flatten this curve and not generate this peak. Because if we generate this peak and 18% are severely or critically ill, there is no way our country, our system, has the capacity to manage that onslaught, or what I call this tsunami. However, it's in our control. I'm going to talk a little bit about the science of soap. Simple things like the science of soap and the power of soap. This idea of washing your hands that you're told is a kindergarten days is not trivial as it relates to this disease. It's not trivial as it relates to not overwhelming the healthcare system. And it's not trivial in terms of exponentially spreading this disease.
More of the science behind the coronavirus when we return.
The Pepin family wants you to know Pepin Lumber is still open for business. To protect our customers during this unprecedented time, knock on the door and we'll service you at our window. The 8-foot and shorter shop is still open, as well as the lumber yard. For now, our regular hours are 7:30 to 3, Monday through Saturday. Have questions? Call us now at 769-8128 or message us on Facebook. Pepin Lumber, 830 Cumberland Hill Road, still serving the community since 1947.
More of the science behind the coronavirus. Now, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong.
The purpose of this presentation was not only to try and allay fears, but also to provide information that we as a community and as a nation can actually control. So I really feel it was important for me to speak about the science of soap, because we can not only control, we can prevent the spread. I'll speak a little bit about how long does the viruses last on surfaces, on the surfaces, with the surfaces of your hand or surfaces of your computer, your phone, and how we can do containment. Lessons we could learn from China. And then we'll speak a little bit about the role of testing, lessons we can learn from Korea. I recognize that we are in a little bit of a bind because of the lack of testing. But I think what we are, what we can do now is understand that perhaps, even without testing, we can now control and prevent the spread. So let me speak about the science of soap. The viruses are not bacteria. So antibacterial soap is a myth in, as it relates to killing the viruses, because it has this fatty, greasy layer on its as an envelope, loves getting onto surfaces that will to which it will adhere, such as your hand. So your hand is a vector. But if you took this vector of the hand and understood the science of soap, where the virus has this fatty layer and the skin is the surface, detergent, straightforward regular detergent, dishwasher fluid, hair shampoo, detergent, soap, acts as a surfactant. What does that mean? It actually goes and orientates itself, these soap particles, towards the fatty layer of the virus. And in so doing, it actually orientates and lifts off these viruses and creates this clean surface. So we have the ability to understand that the science of soap, its natural ability to act as a detergent, the ability, the reason why you need at least 20 seconds, because your hands have nooks and crannies. You need the detergent to enter onto and create this interaction with the virus. You then need to rub and wash because you need it to be lifted from the surfaces. However, what's exciting about this virus is because it is a envelope virus. And that, by the way, is its Achilles heel. Because what does the soap do? The soap has an ability to crack that envelope. And if it cracks that envelope, you're able to kill that virus. So each one of us has the ability to be washing your hands and cracking that envelope and preventing the spread. This is the power and the science of soap. What have we learned from Korea? Well, it turns out to prevent the overwhelming of the healthcare system, and in fact to protect healthcare workers, one can do drive-by testing. And I think this is a national initiative which we should take on and learn this experience from Korea. What have we learned from China? China has taken the draconian step of containment. We are unfortunately beyond that point now. And so we are now left then, therefore, with the opportunity to control it, at least within your control, of actually taking on the power and the science of soap. The question is always asked, what is the hope for a cure today? And also, what can we do to prevent infection in the first place? Well, as we talked about, what we can do to prevent infection in the first place is this issue of self-containment, washing your hands, the power of soap. And frankly, the most important, one of the most important things is the elbow bump. Stop doing handshaking. The issue of the cure is a complex issue because we have to talk about what is the difference between a treatment for those that are ill versus what is a vaccine that'll prevent the infection from happening. And I'll try and address that. I'll try and explain the difference between a treatment and a vaccine. But I think we also would like to discuss what new treatments are being developed today. And I'm excited to say that the entire world community of scientists and pharmaceutical companies and biotechnology companies are frantically working 24/7 to find new treatments that are being developed. I'll have to address with scientific vigor about how long will a vaccine take to develop. But I think of great concern is what is our manufacturing capacity should we need some of these vaccines or these treatments urgently. So let's start. The first question is, how long will it take to develop a treatment or vaccine? First, let's even talk about what's the difference between a treatment versus a vaccine, because I think there's a lot of confusion around there. A vaccine is like that what you have for flu. We create a shot, a subcutaneous shot, and using a vector, sometimes a common cold vector, or what we call an adenovirus, in which we put the sequence of this SARS-CoV-2 into this to train and educate your body to recognize this virus and have readily available killer cells to prevent you getting infected. That's a vaccine. Unfortunately, that'll take a while to develop because testing needs to be done about the effectiveness of that vaccine in giving you true protection. On the other hand, we have patients that are ill, critically ill, mildly ill, that we can take a patient that is mildly ill and prevent from becoming critically ill. We can take a patient that's critically ill from becoming severely to the point of fatally ill, and to understand how we can do that. I think treatment for these kinds of patients are much closer at hand. This virus works by hijacking a receptor in your body. It takes this receptor, uses the machinery of the lung, and actually replicates and infects the lung to the point of fibrosis and death. Worse, this virus has found a way to evade the immune system. It's found a way to actually kill the natural killer cells in your body, the T cells in your body. From the data again from China, what we've discovered is that the patients who die, not only are they elderly, but they have a low natural killer cell and T cell count. So we're beginning to understand this complex biology of this virus. And that's why I'm saying we're looking at it from a perspective not about the virus, but the host. So if we could understand the host's reaction and create counter reactions to this, we have a shot for treatment. So let me speak a little bit about treatment. There are multiple strategies. The first strategy is to take this concept that the virus has hijacked this receptor in our human body called the ACE. So this ACE receptor is the first port of entry. So if we could block the entry of this virus through this ACE receptor, we could block the entire cascade of its ability to use the engine and the machinery to regenerate. Well, happily and luckily, we have now have scientists, and this is as recently as this month, understanding this ACE receptor through the power of genomics, through the power of supercomputing, through the power of protein folding. This complex receptor in our human body is now being able to understood. And because we can understand this receptor, we can find systems to create decoys and sponges so that this receptor cannot be attacked, so that the virus can be, as a Trojan horse, blocked from entering this. This complex science is now being attacked worldwide by scientists around the world and is a very exciting strategy. The other strategy is to say, could we block the machinery? And the answer to that is yes, because we now understand how this virus replicates. The third strategy is, could we block the what we call the endosomal packaging and block that? And what's exciting is we've now discovered potentially, and I say this potentially because science is not fully borne out, and this is an experience in China, that old drugs repurposed can actually block these packaging systems inside the cell of the human cell and ameliorate this disease. And a fourth strategy is to actually kill the factory of the virus itself. It turns out the way this virus works, it has found a way to kill the natural killer cells and T cells of the human body. From the results we've seen from China in the patients who had a fatal outcome in the elderly, the lymphocytes, or what we call the natural killer cells and T cells, are depleted, significantly depleted. Whether that's an effect of the virus or whether the patients are immunosuppressed or had pre-existing conditions, including cancer, it's not clear yet. But what is important and is clear is that these natural killer cells or T cells are depleted. However, we have in our innate system the ability to kill infected cells. So a very interesting strategy is to activate these natural killer cells that, as you could see from this diagram, has an ability to identify, lock on to, and really push what they call granzymes and into these cells and destroy them. The way it will destroy them, it will actually completely almost dissolve the cell, and in so doing, we can then kill the factory itself. So the opportunity here now is not to affect the virus, but the factory of the virus and prevent its depletion. And in so doing, it may induce also a memory or a vaccine and maybe even have a dual effect of reducing the infection, killing the infected cell, and allowing the patient's own immune system to get reactivated. These are the four opportunities that now face us as strategies for the scientific community to come together and work frantically towards, number one, blocking the receptor, preventing it from entering. Number two, destroying the machinery, preventing it from replicating. Number three, preventing from repackaging and shedding. And number four, killing the factory itself. These are opportunities that gives us hope, and I hope will provide some level of comfort that the world working together will be able to find a way to stop this virus, stop this pandemic, and learn a lot about infectious disease. I think the question that many people are asking is, how long will this pandemic last? What is the duration of the viral load in the patient? Is there any hope that this pandemic will die out? And I think it's very important for us as scientists to explain what we know and explain what we don't know. At this point, I don't think we really understand or know how long this pandemic will last. It could be months, many months. One of the earliest reports is the duration of this viral load in an infected patient lasts in a range of 35 to 37, 38 days. And whether a patient could actually reinfect himself, I think is not quite clear yet. I think the hope that this pandemic will die out, I'm sure with the work of the community of scientists, we will find a way to prevent the regeneration of this particular virus. And I'm convinced that with all the community of scientists working on this disease, a vaccine will be found. But I think it's also important to dispel some myths. The question was to come up as, can I get SARS virus from my pets? Again, it's an unanswered question because there's now just been a recent report of an infected dog from Hong Kong. But the question is, could that pet reinfect humans? There's no evidence today yet that it's transmitted from pets to humans. It's a human-to-human contact. And these are the kinds of information that we will be able to say to you, we don't know. As important, I think, it's important for us not to enter into conversations such as xenophobia. This is a pandemic that affects the world. This is a pandemic where the entire world working together can overcome it. The Chinese, while it started there, this now is across the entire planet, and the Chinese have put out very important scientific and clinical information. And so the concept now of xenophobia is one of the most destructive things I think we can do as it relates to public health and the opportunity for scientists to work together. The public-private relationship, the ability of governments to work together, ability for the community to work together is so critical for us to beat this disease. I'm confident we will do that. I'm confident the science of today will enable us to do that. So with that, I'm sure we'll have questions on coronavirus, more questions on coronavirus. Please feel free to send us your questions or by email to coronavirus@latimes.com, and we'll try our best to answer them as we go through this understanding of the science behind coronavirus and try to not only allay fears, but put you in control of this disease.
When we return, we'll hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Edible Arrangements has gifts for every occasion and locally made fresh Easter gifts too. Easter baskets just got better. Spring is in the air and it's time to celebrate the end of winter with edible Easter gifts from Edible Arrangements. Our Easter gift baskets feature fresh pineapple cut into the shape of rabbits and coated in delicious chocolate. It's a fun, delicious addition. Call 767-2077 and one of our fruit experts will be happy to help. Our store is on Fournier Avenue next to Navigant Credit Union at Park Square.
And now from the presidential update recorded Thursday, March 26th, Dr. Anthony Fauci describes the complicated timeline and process of creating a vaccine, also the risks and different stages of development.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I'm going to change the topic just a little bit because there was a question that came up and I've been asked about this on a couple of media interactions regarding the interventions that we're talking about. And it's important because it's about something that I said yesterday about what we would likely see. Whenever you put the clamps down and shut things down, you do it for two reasons. You do it to prevent the further spread. This would be called mitigation. But you also do it to buy yourself time to get better prepared for what might be a rebound. It may be a rebound that we get things really under control, and then you pull back, which ultimately we're going to have to do. Everybody in the world is going to have to do that. You're either going to get a rebound, or it might cycle into the next season. So what are we going to do to prepare ourselves for that? One of the most important things is one that I mentioned several times from this podium, and that is to clarify a bit about the timeline for vaccines. And would that have any real impact on what we would call a rebound or what we would call a cycling in the season? Certainly, for sure, a vaccine is not going to help us now, next month, the month after. But as I mentioned to you, we went into a phase one trial, and I keep referring to one vaccine. There's more than one. There's a couple of handfuls of vaccines at different stages of development, but they're all following the same course. And the course is you first go into a phase one trial to see if it's safe, and you have very few people, 45 people within a certain age group, all healthy, none at really any great risk of getting infected. And the reason you do that, because you want to make sure that it's safe. And the next thing you do, and that takes about 3 months, easily, maybe more. So that's going to bring us into the beginning or middle of the summer. Then you go to a phase two trial, or what we say 2-3, which means we're going to put a lot of people in there. Now, we hope that there aren't a lot of people getting infected, but it is likely there will be somewhere in the world where that's going on. So it's likely that we will get what's called an efficacy signal, and we will know whether or not it actually works. If, in fact, it does, we hope to rush it to be able to have some impact on recycling in the next season. And like I said, that could be a year to a year and a half. I'm not changing any of the dates that I mentioned. But one of the things that we are going to do that you need to understand that has been a stumbling block for previous development of vaccines, and that is even before you know something works, at risk, you have to start producing it. Because once you know it works, you can't say, great, it works. Now, give me another 6 months to produce it. So we're working with a variety of companies to take that risk. We didn't take it with Zika. That's why, you know, we have a nice Zika vaccine, but we don't have enough to do it because there's no Zika around. Same with SARS. So that's one of the things we're really going to push on, is to be able to have it ready if, in fact, it works. Now, the issue of safety, something that I want to make sure the American public understand. It's not only safety when you inject somebody and they get maybe an idiosyncratic reaction, they get a little allergic reaction, they get pain. There's safety associated. Does the vaccine make you worse? And there are diseases in which you vaccinate someone, they get infected with what you're trying to protect them with, and you actually enhance the infection. You can get a good feel for that in animal models. So that's going to be interspersed at the same time that we're testing. We're going to try and make sure we don't have enhancement. So the worst possible thing you could do is vaccinate somebody to prevent infection and actually make them worse. Next, and finally, with regard to therapies. I mean, we keep getting asked about therapies. There's a whole menu of therapies that are going into clinical trial. As I've told you all, and I'll repeat it again, the best way to get the best drug as quickly as possible is to do a randomized controlled trial so that you know, is it safe and is it effective? If it's not effective, get it off the board and go to the next thing. If it is effective, get it out to the people that need it. So you're going to be hearing over the next month or more about different drugs that are going to go into these randomized controlled trials. And I feel confident, knowing about what this virus is and what we can do with it, that we will have some sort of therapy that give at least a partial, if not a very good, protection in preventing progression of disease. And we'll be back here talking about that a lot, I'm sure. Thank you.
Finally, a message from the mayor of the city of Woonsocket on what to do if you are experiencing symptoms of the coronavirus.
I do want to just mention the COVID hotline, which is 222-8022. That is the line that we're asking people to reach out to if they're feeling any of the symptoms that are in line with COVID-19. Please do not go to a local hospital and do not go to your doctor's office. Reach out to your doctor or reach out to this hotline and they will help you work through it with you, see if you need to be tested and do what they can to help you.
We hope you found this WNRI special on the coronavirus informative. Stay safe and healthy.